And welcome to the first arguments of the term to be held in our courtroom. The first case today is United States v. Hamilton. Is the appellant ready? The government? The appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Todd Swenson, and along with my co-counsel, Captain Mark Schwartz, we represent Senior Airman Darian Hamilton, the appellant in this case. Chief Judge Stuckey, may I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
You may.
This court should set aside the appellant's sentence because the military judge abused his discretion in admitting prosecution exhibits during sentencing that did not comply with the requirements of Rule for Court-Martial 1001A, or the minimum standards of reliability under the military rules of evidence. This evidence provided new ammunition that substantially influenced appellant's sentence because the information contained in these admitted exhibits differed from the themes and harms generally contained in victim impact statements in these types of cases.
1001 Alpha contemplate statements or the right of a victim to be reasonably heard being offered by the government as a prosecution exhibit?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
So why doesn't Barker end this case? Yeah, in your favor.
Well, I think
at least on the substantive issue, I don't know about the prejudice issue.
I believe it does. More specifically, the statement of Prosecution Exhibit 5 did not contain victim impact, but was an emotionally charged endorsement of law enforcement, prosecutors, and the judge who worked her child abuse case. The military judge abused his discretion in admitting Prosecution Exhibits 4, 5, and 6 because he did not follow the requirements of 1001 Big Alpha. Despite being unsworn victim impact statements, trial counsel introduced and the military judge admitted and considered these victim impact statements as matters in aggravation during the government's case. The military judge and trial counsel both discussed RCM 1001 Little Alpha and 1001 Big Alpha interchangeably, oftentimes without distinguishing between the two. At one point, the military judge, in overruling trial defense counsel's objection to Prosecution Exhibit 5, stated, under 1001 little A4, which this court would note that doesn't exist in the MCM, in terms of what evidence may be considered an aggravation, it does allow fairly broad discretion with regards to what actually constitutes evidence in aggravation. In addition, evidence of victim impact is fairly broad in terms of what falls under evidence of victim impact. And based on the testimony of the witness, and here he was referring to the detective the government brought in to lay foundation, as to what is contained within the video, I'm going to overrule that objection. I will give it the due weight that I believe it deserves under the law.
So are you arguing that military judge actually was admitting these exhibits under 1000 as 1001B4 evidence?
Yes, ma'am, Your Honor. It seems from the record that several times they mentioned evidence in aggravation. At least 9 times during the course of pre-sentencing, the military judge and trial counsel referred to 1001 without differentiating between little A and big A. Just say 1001.
So then are you arguing in the alternative that either A, this information didn't comport with the requirements of 1001 Big Alpha, or B, it was improperly admitted under 1001 B4 because the proper foundation was not laid? I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm asking you.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think both would be applicable. 1001 Big Alpha definitely was not followed, and the confusion with the discussion between trial counsel and the military judge seemed to imply that either the judge didn't understand the law and how to admit it, or just didn't see the difference between these victim impact statements as aggravation under 1001B4 or Big Alpha.
Well, what are they? What are these creatures?
Victim impact statements.
Yes. I'm asking you, what are they? What is their purpose? What are they floating around the courtroom for?
Well, Article 6B...
It seems to me that one of the things they float around for is to aggravate or to give, you know, to put it in a more mellow fashion, to give a humanizing cover to whatever it was that the victim suffered. Presumably, if the victim, one, suffered and two, suffered at the hands of the appellant. I'm asking, I'm not saying.
The appellant's position is that even if these come under 1001 Big Alpha as unsworn victim impact statements, the effect is still the same, that they are aggravating.
So therefore they should be excluded altogether? Or what?
Not excluded altogether, Your Honor. I mean, we still have...
There's no question of instructions here because it's judge alone, and there's also the presumption that the judge knows what he's doing. But I'm kind of at a loss. I don't quite know where you guys are, where the defense is on this thing. What are you maintaining?
That these were... We have 1001 Big Alpha, which is the implementation of Article 6B for a victim to
right.
be reasonably heard.
Right.
That these should comply with 1001A.
Okay.
But that said, that they still seem to be aggravating evidence, even if admitted under 1001A.
Is it a one or the other proposition? They either comply or they're aggravating, or they comply and they're I still don't quite understand where you are.
Well, if according to the rules, if they come in under 1001B4,
yeah,
they are sworn.
Yeah.
So therefore their testimony.
Right, right. So you've got that problem.
Yes. Your Honor.
Right.
But it could essentially be the same exact statement if it's admitted under 1001.
Okay, so it turns on, so it doesn't turn on the content of the statement or perhaps the intent in admitting it, or, well, if you speak of admitting something that's unsworn.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I mean, is it the case that under Article 6B, Article 6, right, provides a reasonable opportunity to be heard, right, that the victim has a right to be reasonably heard.
Yes, Your Honor.
Correct? And that's the analogy of they get to put either a sworn or an unsworn statement about the impact of the offense on them. Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And similarly, and it doesn't have to be sworn, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And would you agree that if it's not sworn testimony, that it's not evidence as such? I'm just saying, similar, it's their right to say, this really hurt me, this really bad things happened. Similarly, and that might be aggravating, right? But similarly, the accused can make an unsworn statement, right? And say, you know, I had a horrible childhood, I didn't mean to do this, my friend, whatever, right? And they can't be cross-examined on that, and that can be mitigating, even though it's not sworn testimony either.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. Okay.
And the difficulty in this is it can be the same, whether it'd be the same statement, the same facts therein, if it's sworn or unsworn. And so the appellant's position is that these are aggravating factors and that there needs to be some indicia of reliability, authenticity.
Well, I mean, that would go to the requirements of 1001 Big Alpha being followed, right, which is that the person is offering the statement to the court, right? So you know who that person is, for one thing, as opposed to an anonymous, unsworn statement.
Under Barker, yes. But in this case, as in Barker, all information on the identity of these victims, including their ages, were redacted and unknown to the...
Well, and they didn't offer this statement, right? So this goes back to they did not offer the statement as 1001 Alpha, Big Alpha requires. Right? So the indicia of reliability and all
yes,
of those
Honor.
Other things were not can not possibly be complied with.
Yes, Your Honor. It's very confusing in this case. It seems in some instances the government was attempting to admit it under
if the government was going to admit these statements in this video under as 1001B4 evidence, right? In its initial case in aggravation, so the rules of evidence have not been relaxed. What would they have need to do? What would they need to do to put these statements in?
Well, these statements would need to be authenticated. They need to be reliable. So presumably this victim needs to appear in court and testify, or there has to be some foundation laid to these statements, and they are what they purport to be. So the identity, the age, enough information that allows the accused to contact this victim for cross-examination purposes.
Counsel, can we switch gears and talk about prejudice, assuming that we conclude that the statements were improperly admitted? You say in your brief that the standard is material prejudice to substantial right, and I think the government's position is that the statements were brief, they didn't really contain that much relevant information, and it was somewhat obvious that this would be the result of any victim. Why would we find prejudice here?
Well, the prejudice, Your Honor, stems from the video, Prosecution Exhibit 5. The military judge admitted that before looking at it. We can tell from the record. And he stated that he would give it the due weight it deserves under the law. And the first piece of this video is that it did not contain any victim impact whatsoever. This was a speech that the victim gave and praising and endorsing law enforcement, the judge, and the prosecutors, and in fact, in some instances, belittling the defense attorney's representation of the assailant in this case. And so we see statements such as, "Kevin is my hero and he's family to me." That was the detective who found her, investigated the case. The police, lawyers, judges were heroes.
But why wouldn't a military judge be particularly adept at realizing that that should have no effect on the sentencing?
There's a few arguments to that, sir, is that he admitted this as victim impact when it wasn't victim impact. And so we can assume that he considered this. And
well, he said that he was going to give it due weight under the law. It was Judge Alone, and as Judge Maggs noted, you've got to show that there was a substantial influence on the sentence. So what is in that video that would cause us to believe that there truly was a substantial influence on the sentence in a Judge Alone sentencing?
Typically in these cases, we see what we saw in Prosecution Exhibits 4 and 6, the victim talking about real victim impact. Here in Prosecution Exhibit 5, we have a face to the victim here. We have the victim tearing up during the process. We have a voice to what we usually have is just words on paper. And we can't be confident that this didn't impact the military judge.
But that's not the standard. The standard is not, can you be confident, judges, that it didn't have an impact.
Yes, Your Honor. And the alternative argument to this is that the military judge stated that he would give it the due weight it deserves under the law.
Which may be nothing.
Which may be nothing. But he didn't.
But I've got another question. Is it your position that it's the medium that's the message? In other words, the fact that she teared up and it was a video makes a difference?
That's our position, Your Honor.
Oh, then, in other words, the use of videos is per se unlawful?
1001A allows for written or oral or both. It doesn't mention video as a permissible.
Well, if she comes in and cries, isn't that substantially a bigger sock in the face than if she cries on a video?
Potentially,
that's
yes,
oral.
Sir. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but it's the defense's position that the use of a video is per se not allowed.
In 1001 Big Alpha, yes.
Okay,
Your Honor. We see if the president wanted to implement video as a medium in this instance, he could have. We see at least eight other rules in the RCM that allow for video or video conferencing during.
Well, that's fair enough. I'm just trying to find out what it is your position is.
Counsel, in our calculations, why shouldn't we find that the government case was strong, sentencing case, and the defense case was weak at sentencing?
Why should you find that?
Why should we not find the government case was strong in sentencing and the defense case was weak in sentencing? I mean, after all, the appellant pleaded guilty. He laid out the reasons for his guilt. The military judge saw the egregious images, all going for the government. On the defense side, he had a newspaper article, one letter of commendation. There's really nothing there, is there?
Your Honor, I wouldn't call it a particularly strong on the defense side, but the differences that we see in this case as opposed to typical cases in child pornography and not taken away from the seriousness of the offense, but we have the video. We have a military judge who stated he would give it the due weight it deserves under the law, but he didn't consider, he didn't know the law and how to get these in. And so the confusion is, I see I'm out of time.
But please continue to finish answering the question.
That he's presumed to know the law, but it's clear from the record that he didn't understand the law in terms of aggravation evidence versus unsworn victim, because it was all the same during the process. The other factor we see here is... About
counsel, though, what's also clear in the record is with this egregious case, the accused only got 2 years of imprisonment.
Yes, that is true, Your Honor.
So that weighs against your argument there, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
Counsel, could you be prepared to address and rebuttal what, if any, case in mitigation the appellant put on in sentencing?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
Morning, Chief Judge Suki, members of the court. May it please the court, I'm Captain Mike Bunnell. Ms. Mary Ellen Payne and I represent the United States in this proceeding. A victim's right to be reasonably heard through an unsworn statement is not subject to the military rules of evidence because that right is a right of allocution similar to that of the accused. And the military judge in this
case... Could you speak up a little?
Yes, the military judge in this case did not abuse his discretion when he allowed the child pornography victims to exercise that right.
Well, yes, he did, because a right of allocution is personal to the victim, and the victims were nowhere to be seen.
Correct. I don't think that's false. I don't think that creates an insurmountable problem.
because what we don't have the victim.
Well, if it's their right, right, then they can exercise it. And if the government wants to put the evidence on in aggravation, it can exercise its right to put it in under 1001B4. But what the government can't do, right, what the government can't do is take aggravation evidence under 1001B4 and shoehorn it in under 1001 Big Alpha without complying with all the rules in 1001 Big Alpha.
Well, a couple of answers to that. The first off is I think that this we're not making a case for aggravation evidence, but our position is that the victims in this case actually did request that they're to exercise their right to be reasonably heard. And here's how we get there. So, yeah, there's no evidence that they knew who Airman Hamilton was. There's no evidence that they were aware that this case was happening. But here is why it's very different than Barker. We have four very important things. Under oath, whether through affidavit or through live testimony, we have somebody saying, look, I'm in contact with this victim. I know this victim personally. I've seen the images. You've got the right victim. You've got the right statement. I've seen the statement. And they want it considered.
If they don't even know about this case, right, they haven't asked that it be considered in this case. And so when you add an unidentified victim who's unsworn, I think you have some real due process problems.
Well, I think the analysis is going to turn less on RCM 1001A and more on Article 6B. And so I think inherent in what I hear you saying is the idea that we treat the RCMs or this particular provision in the RCMs as prescriptive.
No, I think what you hear me saying is that the statute says that they have the right to be reasonably heard and that the procedure that you're describing isn't reasonable at all.
Well, I think that's a good question there. What is reasonable? Of course, they've taken up that question. So that modifier is an important modifier, and we believe it actually opens the aperture for available options to the victim. And that's not simply our opinion. I think that's what the courts that have interpreted this statute, obviously there's not a lot of military precedent on point, but I think that the provenance of Article 6B is helpful here because it's...
Well, to follow up on Judge Ryan, can the putative victim simply issue an all-encompassing request to prosecutors, federal, state, and local, throughout the country, that every time one of these pops up, I want to be heard?
I think the answer to that is yes, if the circumstances are reasonable. That's what I'm trying to get at with this idea.
What's reasonable?
If you don't know who the person is, how can you rebut what they say?
Well,
if they have not asked the court, if they have not requested the court, as the rule requires, right, that they would like to be heard through a sworn or an unsworn statement, right, how can anything that is put in possibly be rebutted?
Well, I think, first of all, let's say, for example, that the victim shows up, that there's no notice provided, there's no anything. She just shows up, she says, I want to exercise my right to be heard, and she leaves. I think that we would agree that's exercising the right to be reasonably heard. How is the defense able to, what mechanism is there in the rule to say, well, we got to call her back and ask her about this. We got to know who this person is. We got to say, hey, you're a victim.
All she said is, I want to be heard.
Correct.
That's all she said.
Well, I mean, we find that she's a victim, right? So that she goes to the court. There's no notice provided, but she says, look, I am this victim. I would like to be heard on this issue. The judge says, looks like you're the victim. Go ahead and be heard. She walks out of the room. How different
without
is that?
Without being heard?
No, after providing.
You got me totally confused.
This is becoming very
Oh, she goes in, she's heard, and then she walks away.
My apologies. Yes, she gives her unsworn statement, or let's say she just drops it off. Apologies. Yes, she makes the statement. She goes, she makes the statement, or just delivers the statement and walks out. And what in the rules suggests that would be impermissible? They can still, if there's anything in there that they want to try to rebut, they're welcome to, but they're not entitled to any sort of discovery or anything to that effect.
But one distinction there between the position you took earlier is an issue of staleness. Here we have her showing up to the court martial. Based on the scenario that you were presenting us with earlier, you could have a victim impact statement that is very stale. Someone who is at age 18 gives a statement. It could be 18 years later. The detective could say, I maintain my contact with this woman. Here's the statement. And yet the circumstances could be very different.
I think the circumstances could be very different, but the testimony would not be. And so what the rule that I'm suggesting, that the content of a request would include not just contact with the victim, but also testimony saying, look, this is what she wants now. I can attest to it because I am in contact with her. So it's not stale.
So, but aren't you in that scenario saying that, in fact, the hypothetical detective has notified the victim of this particular court-martial? And that's different than what we have here.
I think in that, it doesn't have to be that, I guess is my answer. And I think part of the problem here is I think we're approaching the question in, I guess, through the wrong lens. We're focusing a lot on RCM 1001A. What are the requirements? As if they're a sort of hoop that everyone has to jump through in order to...
Well, doesn't Barker require?
We are approaching. Who is the we to whom you refer?
I think everybody in this analysis, I think there's a tendency, ourselves included, to spend so much time on RCM 1001A, we forget Article 6B. And I think...
Well, what about Barker? How do you get past Barker?
Well, I think the Barker language is great because it explicitly says the threshold test is either the presence or request of the victim, and we are making...
In a particular case.
Correct, and it's our position...
See, I asked you that question earlier, you said the reverse. I said, can she simply issue a blanket statement that whenever this pops up, 10 years from now, I want to be heard? With no reference to any specific accused or trial. And you said, yeah.
Well, let me...
What's your position?
Let me clarify, because that's not exactly what I meant. What I meant to say is if
okay,
we have these four things. So if the detective can get up and say, even if it's 10 years later, look, I am in contact with this victim. I've seen the images. You have the right images. This is the right girl. I've seen the statement. You have the right statement. And I'm telling you, given my contact currently with her, she wants this heard. Then there's no staleness issue. The blanket statement becomes an immediate statement.
But he's not a victim advocate, and he's not her.
Correct.
Right? And it was offered as a prosecution, and sort of bolstering my view of how this is being used, it was offered as a prosecution exhibit.
They bungled the way that it was offered.
Well, no, the CCA tried to fix it after the fact by saying that it was bungled. It wasn't bungled at all. It was offered exactly how they intended it to be offered.
I think I agree with the CCA here. I think when you look at the context of what they're happening, they're using the wrong nomenclature, but they're not exactly treating it as if it's aggravation evidence.
Well, it's entirely unclear what they're doing, right? I mean, they've mixed and matched all of the rules to such an extent, it's completely unclear what it was that they were doing or how they considered this. So let me ask you this. If these statements or this video were going to be offered under 1001B4, what would the government have had to do to get them admitted?
I think they'd have problems with hearsay, first of all, so I don't know if they could offer them unless the rules have been relaxed.
Okay, but it's the government goes first, so the rules have not been relaxed. Do you agree the government can't ask to relax the rules when it's putting out its initial aggravation case, right?
Correct. Yeah, so if that didn't happen, if they were offering this, I don't think it's admissible as aggravation evidence under the facts that we have.
Okay, so why then would we allow the government to offer it as hearsay, not complying with the rules as 1001 alpha evidence?
Because 1001 big alpha evidence it's the victim's right. She has the right to be heard, and our position is that she's manifesting that request. She's just using another person to communicate it. And so I think again, the idea of being Article 6B, the right to be reasonably heard, that modifier reasonable actually opens the aperture of available options for the victim.
And no, I think it actually limits it.
So
they have a right to be heard would be an absolute edict, that they have a right to be heard anytime, any place, anyhow, irrespective of the constitutional issues that might present.
Right? I think that's not
they
how...
They can reasonably, you know, put some limits. And I don't know how you're reading it otherwise.
Well, I'm looking at the precedent and the legislative history. So courts have asked this question, what does the reasonable word mean? And right to be reasonably heard, the courts that come to mind are Degenhardt, Kenna, and Burkholder. And they pull out the same legislative history. And what they point to is the Senate report and the floor hearings that say explicitly, look, it is important that the reasonably heard language not be an excuse for minimizing the victim's opportunity to be heard.
But see, the problem, and I'm not going to beat this anymore, but I just want you to understand the problem I'm having with your whole line of argument, which is just as an accused has a personal right of allocution to stand up in court and have an unsworn statement saying whatever the heck they want, subject to the government's right to rebut it. I mean, yeah, subject to the government's right to rebut it. So, too, the victim has this singular right to come to court and tell the judge, I want to be heard, right? Here's my unsworn statement. I want to make an unsworn statement. I want to make a sworn statement. Here's my written unsworn statement. I would like you to consider it in this case, right?
Okay.
That's not, the police officer comes and says, I know this person, and she said she wants to be heard in all cases, and I can attest to that. It's not her exercising her right. It's him purporting to exercise her right on her behalf in every case,
and yeah,
not this particular case. And it's not what the rules require, and the rules are what implement 6B.
I think that that's the crux of my argument, is the rules are...
We were wrong in Barker.
No, I don't think... I think that the...
This is not distinguishable for Barker, and if you think that it is, you didn't read it correctly.
I'm leery to tell you what you meant in your own opinion, but I do think
it's not my opinion, it's the opinion of the court.
I apologize, I meant to the court generally, but what I mean to say is I think the language in Barker allows for what I'm saying, and it's factually distinguishable from what happened there, where you have 7 pages of highly redacted, you have one sentence in one of the statements that seems to suggest authorship, and we don't know, we've got a proffer from trial counsel where we can't tell you who the detective is. Here we have something completely different. And so as far as, again, I think that the key for us in understanding this issue is the fact that it's turning on Article 6B, the right to be reasonably heard. If you look at the provenance of this of Article 6B, it's conspicuously drafted after the CVRA. And our federal circuits have weighed in on what this right to be reasonably heard.
Why don't you turn to prejudice?
Go ahead.
After Judge Stuckey asked his question, why don't you turn to prejudice, specifically prejudice on sentencing, not prejudice on the findings, because obviously he pleaded guilty.
Okay. My question is simply, to me, and I think maybe to Judge Ryan as well, reasonably is a modifier. And you're saying, yeah, reasonably is a modifier, and what it says was it opens the jaws wide, and she can basically do what she pleases in any manner she pleases, and that seems counterintuitive to me, but please go ahead and address prejudice.
Is it all right if I respond to that and then address prejudice?
Please do.
So I want to be clear what I'm saying and what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that the floodgates are now open and the victim can say anything. I'm saying the word reasonable requires for a contextual analysis of what's going on. And it seems to me that that word is influenced by its association. I think the Latin phrase is nostra associis.
Well, so now I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'm going to. So you just said that you didn't mean to suggest that it meant that it could come in, they could do whatever they want, but you suggest the exact opposite. You say that the rules of evidence don't apply, and that basically that would mean that they can do whatever they want, no matter how prejudicial it is, no matter how lacking in legal and factual relevance, as long as you can somehow squish it into the words of the rule, right, that they can do it, and no one can stop them.
I'm not sure I understand the question, but I do think that the right to be heard...
It's a statement about what you say in your brief, which is that the rules of evidence, including 403, don't apply. And so how isn't that saying they can say and do whatever they want, in whatever manner they choose?
I think the analogy to look at is it's an indefeasible right of allocution similar to that of the accused. So the accused can get up in sentencing and present this type of allocution, and all we're saying is that the victim can now do that as well. It's not saying that there are no restrictions.
So what you just said to Judge Stuckey is the exact opposite of what you're saying now.
Following up on that, counsel, can I lay out a syllogism here and find out where you would disagree with it? Premise A is that federal rules of evidence apply to all aspects of a court-martial, except for when there are specific exceptions. Premise B would be that there are no exceptions for victim impact statements. And the conclusion would be, therefore, the military rules of evidence apply to victim impact statements. Where's the problem in either the premises or the conclusion there in that syllogism?
I think the analogy here is the accused's unsworn statement. I don't think syllogistically.
I'm not talking about the analogies that you're making. I'm talking about the plain language in the code that says that the military rules of evidence apply to all aspects of court-martial proceedings except for when there are exceptions. And there is no explicit exception for victim impact statement. So I understand your point in terms of you talking about analogies to unsworn statements by the accused. I understand your point about in the federal courts, I think there are significant distinctions there. But I'm just saying, if we're looking at the plain language here of the code, how do you get past that plain language?
I think that you look to the plain language of Article 6B. The right to be reasonably heard is...
Why doesn't that mean in proportion with the rules of evidence?
Because I think...
Except insofar as it says that the statement could be unsworn.
I think this court's opinion in ORM versus Kastenberg is kind of explaining what I mean to say, and that is to be heard, whether it's modified by or reasonable or not, that statement means a right of allocution outside the rules of evidence. And I think that's what the court points out, that in every instance where in the MREs or the RCMs use the phrase to be heard, it's talking about argument as opposed to the introduction of evidence. And so, for example, maybe there's something in the MRE. Judge Wilson, it feels like you're asking where in the MREs does it make the exception, and it doesn't. Similarly, it doesn't make the exception for the accused on sworn statement. There's no 603 exception in the MREs.
You're saying that the rules of evidence apply in no way to an accused statement, that the military judge can't put any limits on what the accused says or does?
No, Judge Ryan, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that there can be no strictures implied. I'm just saying that the strictures come from the rule itself, as opposed to the MREs.
I guess I just have one. Go ahead.
Just in your time remaining, could you address the prejudice? And I think it was the appellant's position in the brief that, you know, the government's case consisted only of the pictures and the statements, and that at sentencing argument, trial counsel referred to the statements about 20 times. And so if we were to conclude that they were improperly admitted, why wouldn't we find material prejudice?
The answer to that is we think this case is, from a prejudice standpoint, indistinguishable from Barker. It's a military judge alone case. He is presumed to know the themes and harms that these individuals had already experienced. If we go through the Harrell factors and we look at the strength of the government's case, like Barker, there is a very robust statement of fact. You have the most egregious content that I think you can imagine, but also you have the fact that he uploaded it to a public website that isn't password protected, isn't privacy protected. Then you look at the comparative weakness of the defense's case, where they have three character letters, a picture of the coins, his unsworn statement. You have an article about a family car accident, which is, it's tragic, but I guess in comparison, it really doesn't compare with the strength and the robustness of the government's case. When you look at the materiality of the evidence, again,
But if he's to be punished for the offense that he's charged with, and if all of the sentencing evidence is focused on these individuals who haven't said anything about how his particular actions impacted them, you don't think that's problematic?
I don't think it is, because the judge is presumed to know these things. And I think, again,
to know what things?
To know the law. He's presumed to know what he can consider and what he can't consider.
Do you think that his discussion of victim impact statements and the different rules was a model of clarity?
I don't think it was a model of clarity, but I think that's it's a loaded question. I do think he understood what could be considered in his deliberations and what couldn't.
So if he understood then that he couldn't consider any of this because it was improperly before him, right, either inadmissible under 1001b4 or inadmissible under 1001b alpha, what was he left to base his sentencing on from the government's case in aggravation?
Chief Judge Suki, I'm out of time.
Please answer the question.
I think that the sentence is driven from the egregiousness of the crimes and not the content of statements that he's already presumed to know the content of.
Thank you, counsel. If I may be permitted an observation before rebuttal, I think that confusion in this area would be remedied by a renumbering of the rules. Counsel, you may have rebuttal.
1001?
Alpha, little alpha, B, whatever.
1001 Zulu.
That has to, yeah. Has occurred.
Counsel, you may have rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Judge Stuckey. Judge Ryan, in response to your question, the first mitigating factor we have is that the appellant pled guilty in that he waived all waivable motions, didn't put up a fight with the government, therefore saving money. We have a few character statements, and we also have the victim, the accused statement in which he talks about being essentially orphaned by his parents, abandoned by his mother, abused by his father his entire life. He had a grandmother that was killed in front of him when he was four in a car accident. He was in another car accident as a service member where he witnessed two more people perish. And with that background, relatively young still at the age of 25 when he committed these crimes.
When you say he was abused by his father, was it physical or sexual abuse?
Physical.
And the government's argument, since we know what they put in aggravation, what use did they make of the offenses writ large as opposed to focus on the particular items that were admitted by the military judge?
Well, if a close examination of the government's sentencing argument, we see them refer to Bree at least 11 times, which was the proponent of Prosecution Exhibits 4 and 5. And with Prosecution Exhibit 6, we see them refer to the only name we have is Jessica approximately 9 times. Though taken by itself, that may not seem too have much influence, but when you look at the surrounding language, such as mercy, these girls weren't shown mercy. Why should the accused have mercy? It's all very, they use these.
That's a good argument, but the military judge knows he doesn't consider any of that, does he? I mean, he doesn't care, or he's not supposed to care, that, the trial counsel's argument is mentioning the victim 5 times. Doesn't the military judge know that that's not evidence?
The law
is. He's not swayed by the possibly over-the-top language by any counsel in argument, is he? That can't be part of your reason for prejudice, can it?
Judge Sparks, it wasn't really inflammable language so much as it was reference to these exhibits that were improperly admitted.
Right.
So is it your point that he didn't know they were improperly admitted or he wouldn't have admitted them and the whole government sentencing argument was based on the exhibits?
If I'm understanding you, Judge Ryan, yes, that he didn't know the law and he admitted these as aggravation. We don't know that he didn't consider these an aggravation. He did not articulate at all on the record what he would consider and not consider despite the mess.
Is he required to?
Exactly if he's required to do that. I don't think so because the presumption is he knows the law, but that presumption is
rebutted, you think, in this case? Is that what your argument is?
He rebuts it himself by not articulating on the record and by confusing 1,000. He mentions in a decision or in one of his rulings for admitting 1001A4, which doesn't even exist in the MCI.
Well, let me ask you one more question before your time runs out here. Now, all of the considerations you've mentioned earlier about the accused mitigation case, is it your position that these victim impact statements completely negated, in the mind of the judge, negated all of the other things about the offense, and the number of times the victim was victimized, and all the other factors the government put up? Your position is that these victim impact statements negated all of that?
Chief Judge Suki, if I may answer.
Yes, please answer the question.
I don't know specifically. He didn't articulate on the record, but we can. But I think in parts it did, especially when looking at Prosecution Exhibit 5, where, again, we don't know, but maybe for the first time, this judge in a child pornography case saw the victim's face, saw the victim cry.
And your view would be that had that not happened, he would have gotten a lesser sentence in this case, less than 2 years in a bad conduct discharge?
We can't be confident that wasn't the result because the record is so confusing.
Well, that would only be speculation, right? You can
say more or less, yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:35.
All rise. The court stands in recess until 10:35.